Welcome, and thank you for standing by. All participants will be able to listen only for the duration of today's conference. If you should need assistance, press star, then zero, and a support person will assist you. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to your host for today, Mr. Scott Woods. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you very much. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today for Broadband USA's monthly webinar on broadband topics of interest to policymakers, decision-makers, practitioners, and consumers. I am Scott Woods, and I manage Broadband USA's Technical Assistance Program, and I will be moderating the webinar today. This afternoon, our topic is Electric Co-ops Bringing Fiber to Rural America. Our presenters today are Brett Kilbourne, Vice President of Policy and General Counsel, the Utilities Technology Council; Randy Clint, Founder at Conexon and General Manager of Ozarks Go, LLC; and Paul Belk, the President and CEO of the North Georgia Network, Incorporated. These presenters are experienced leaders in rural electrical cooperatives' deployment, expansion, and operation of broadband network infrastructure. I would like to point out a few governing instructions before we begin. First, we will open up the webinar for after the presentations to answer your questions. Please use the question box on the right-hand side of the screen to submit any questions or comments you may have. Second, the presentations, along with a transcript and recording, will be available on the Broadband USA website within 7 days of this webinar, under the tab entitled Events/BBUSA Webinar Archives. Our website also provides you with information about our technical assistance program, guides, products, publications, and other tools that can assist you with the planning, funding, and implementation of your broadband project. As we begin, our first speaker is Brett Kilbourne. Again, he's the Vice President of Policy and General Counsel of the Utilities Technology Council. He is primarily responsible for UTC's advocacy activities before the Federal Communications Commission and other federal agencies on matter affecting the communications and information technology interests of UTC's member utility companies. Utility broadband is one of the UTC's key policy issues, and UTC has been an active participant in various FCC proceedings, including the Connect America Fund, which supports broadband deployment to unserved areas of America. Please welcome Brett Kilbourne.
All right. Thanks, Scott, for that kind introduction, and thanks to Broadband USA for the opportunity for me and UTC to talk a little bit about utility broadband. So a little bit about UTC. We were founded in 1948. We're a global trade association. Our focus is on telecom and IT for all kinds of electric, gas, and water utilities and other critical infrastructure industries. Our members include large investor-owned utilities as well as smaller rural electric cooperative and public power utility companies. We are based in Washington, D.C., and we have affiliates in Europe, Canada, South America, and Africa. We created a Rural Broadband Council in 2012 within UTC. The focus of the RBC was to promote opportunities for broadband funding for rural utilities, but we also provide education, and we inform members through newsletters, webinars, and case studies. And then we also hold conferences where we enable networking with utilities on ways to provide broadband to rural America. And recently, we created a Utilities Broadband Council, and that is a reflection that there are all types of utilities that are providing broadband either on a wholesale or retail basis in urban and rural areas. So the UBC continues the work started by the RBC in 2012 and expands efforts on advocacy, education, and information for and about utility broadband. So let's talk about the current state of broadband. There's a provision within the Communications Act that requires the FCC to regularly examine the availability of quote-unquote advanced telecommunications capability, i.e. broadband. And if it finds that it is not being made available to all Americans on a, quote-unquote, reasonable and timely basis, the FCC is required to take, quote-unquote, immediate action to remove barriers to broadband investment. So the most recent report that the FCC issued as a result of its Section 706 inquiry found that there are 34 million people nationwide that lack access to broadband speeds of 25 megabits per second down and 3 megabits per second up. That represents 4% of people in urban areas. And then when you get to the rural areas, you really start to see this digital divide that exists. So there, the number jumps to 39%, which is 23 million people that lack access to 25.3 megabits per second. And then we look at tribal areas, the number gets even worse. You get 41% or 1.6 million people in tribal areas that lack 25.3 megabits per second access. And then when you talk about schools, the number there is also troubling. You've got 59% of schools that have access to 100 megabits per second per 1,000 students, and far fewer have access to a gig service per 1,000 students. So I've got a couple of maps here that illustrate what we're talking about. So the first slide shows that part of the country in the western half of the country that has access to 10.1 megabits per second speed. And what you're focusing on here is the lightly shaded green areas of the country. Those are the areas that represent service territories that are covered with 10.1 megabits per second. All right, so let's go to the next slide. And then all of a sudden you see just how few parts of the country actually have 25.3 megabits per second, which is the current benchmark for broadband established by the FCC. That gives you a real sense of the gap that exists in terms of the opportunity to provide broadband. And then when you talk about competition in these areas where there's 25.3 megabits per second, most of these areas really only have one provider, if any. There's only a few places that have two. Those are the orange areas. And there's only a very small, small number of places that have three or more, and those are the red shaded areas. So a couple of slides here to sort of illustrate what we're talking about in terms of takeaways. One of the things that's a key point is that the increasing bandwidth that's going to be required from streaming video and audio is going to, you know, drive up the demand for higher speed services. So your typical video and audio, which comprises 63% of downstream traffic, typically requires 5 to 10, 25 megabits per second for each video stream. And then when you stop to consider that the average American household, the children, has more than four people living in it, and they're using seven internet-connected devices on a shared broadband network, that's also going to drive up your bandwidth requirements. So you need to anticipate that if you're thinking about providing broadband in some of these rural areas. Next slide. So the other question is, you know, is there really demand in rural areas for broadband? Is the adoption rate in rural areas going to be strong? And what we are seeing is that where there is 25.3 megabits per second speeds available, the take rate is roughly the same whether you're talking about urban areas or rural. So these are the FCC numbers, right? And so they're showing that it's 30% in urban areas, 28% in rural, roughly equivalent where there's 25.3 megabits per second available. And then last bullet point, there's a group called the Broadband Opportunity Council, and actually now it's being renamed the Broadband Interagency Working Group. But yeah, the report that was issued by the BOC a couple of years ago does find that broadband has steadily shifted from an optional amenity to a core utility for households, businesses, and community institutions. And that today, broadband is taking its place alongside water, sewer, and electricity as essential infrastructure for communities. So next slide. So let's talk about electric costs and broadband. So picking up from that last point from the Broadband Opportunity Council report, electric cooperatives also are seeing broadband today as much like electricity in the 1930s. So the electric cooperatives were generally established back in 1930s in the Depression area to actually bring electricity into those areas that didn't have it. Today, they're seeing that those areas need broadband in order to drive economic opportunity as well. And that's one of the main reasons that electric cooperatives are getting into the broadband space. The other interesting point about it from a cooperative standpoint is that they're committed to serving all their customers, members, in their service areas. So 100% of their customers will be getting broadband. They may, you know, get it in phased deployments, but they're definitely going to get it. And actually, what we're seeing is that cooperatives will actually deploy to neighboring towns to the extent that they're deploying broadband in their service territory. So there's an opportunity there as well. With respect to smart grid, a key driver for utilities is the benefits that go along with having broadband access. You know, that can improve the quality of electric service by improving electric reliability and actually efficiency as well. So the last point about cooperatives is that they are positioned in these rural areas. They were created by their communities. They are committed to those rural communities. There are approximately 900 cooperatives in 47 states, and they provide electric service to 37 million people in almost three-quarters of the nation's landmass. So I put together a slide that illustrates where we've seen some electric cooperatives deploying broadband. I won't go through these in the interest of time. I just wanted to make you aware that these deployments were out there. The other takeaway is that a lot of these deployments are, you know, fiber to the home deployments, which really is remarkable in the sense that, you know, there's a challenge, or at least the mindset is that there's a challenge in deploying fiber in these rural areas, but the cooperatives have been able to do that. So next slide. Let's talk a little bit about the Connect America Fund. As I said, previous slides, ETC's focus has been to try and create opportunities for the cooperatives to be able to tap into the Connect America Fund at the FCC. So a quick status update on that. There's $1.8 billion that's budgeted annually for high-cost services. The price cap carriers were able to accept $1.5 billion of that in model-based support, and that represents $9 billion over the next 6 years. And they are only required to provide speeds of 10.1 megabits per second as part of that right of first refusal. The remainder that's available, $215 million annually or $2.1 billion over the next 10 years, is going to be subject to a competitive bidding reverse auction. So we're positioning the utility companies, educating them on that opportunity. The areas that they can bid on are areas that are unserved currently with 25.3 megabits per second from an unsubsidized provider. There are areas where price cap carriers have declined the right of first refusal, and there are areas where utilities were, quote-unquote, rural broadband experiment applicants to provide Category 1, i.e. 25.3 megabits per second services. In those areas, there represents a pretty significant opportunity for the electric cooperatives to be able to access some of that Connect America Fund money that is available. So some of the states we're talking about include, Missouri, Nevada, Oklahoma. That's where AT&T declined the offer. California and Mississippi, Oklahoma and Wyoming. And then Fairpoint has declined the offer of first refusal in Colorado and Kansas, and then finally Windstream declined in New Mexico. For interested entities that want to try and bid, the FCC has provided a link that shows you precisely which census blocks are available, but that is subject to revision as more FCC 477 data gets filed from year to year. The FCC has established performance tiers and weighting criteria for the CAF II auction. The idea behind that is that this will promote funding for high-speed, low-latency networks. I won't go into the specific performance tiers, but they do range from 1 gigabits per second down to 10.1 megabits per second speeds. And then also there are waiting factors that kick in depending on whether you're offering high latency or low latency services. Right now, the FCC has issued a public notice inviting comment on the specific rules for the reverse auction. The comments have been filed on that, and we're now in the final stage, I guess, before the FCC actually implements the rules for the reverse auction, which we expect is going to take place in early 2018. Next slide. In addition to the FCC's Connect America Fund, there's also the USDA or U.S. Electric Program, which provides loans for electric infrastructure. And the RUS has actually clarified that they recognize that broadband can actually support electric smart grid initiatives. So that is the stated policy, and we can go to the next slide. And as I said, these electric program funds are available for loans to borrowers for fully integrated smart grid purposes, including fiber connections directly to the meters of electric service consumers. And further is the policy of the RUS to promote smart grid deployment among all electric utilities serving rural customers, and smart grid capabilities can improve reliability, promote energy efficiency, enhance grid security, advance safety, provide security, reduce pollution, and restrain consumer electricity costs, all benefits that are brought to you by this program. Next slide. And that is it. Scott, you want to take it away?
Yes, thank you, Brett. As a reminder, we will have time for questions at the end of the day's session. Please use the question box on the right-hand side of your screen to submit questions and or comments. In addition, the presentation from today's webinar will be available on our website within 7 days. Our next speaker is Randy Clint. Mr. Clint is the general manager of Ozarks Go, LLC, a subsidiary of Ozarks Electric Cooperative in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Ozarks is in the process of building a six-phase, 7,000-mile fiber-to-the-home broadband network in northwest Arkansas and northeast Oklahoma. Mr. Clint is also the founder and partner at Connexon, which assists electric cooperatives in evaluating and deploying fiber-to-the-home networks to co-op members and communities. Please welcome Randy Clint.
Thank you, and thank you, NTIA, for hosting this webinar. Thanks, Brett, for your comments. And one note is Ozarks Electric is a proud member of UTC. I'll go on to the next slide, please. Ozarks Electric Cooperative was formed in the 30s, and it's been around for right at 80 years. We have 7,000 miles of electric distribution line, serving 75,000 meters in northwest Arkansas and northeast Oklahoma. Ozarks is one of the most reliable electric utilities in the state of Arkansas, has some of the lowest rates in the state of Arkansas, and has very high customer satisfaction scores. The reason I mention that is that that has created a great foundation for us to build upon what the electric cooperative has accomplished in the last 80 years to build a fiber-to-the-home broadband network. We're also fortunate to be in one of the fastest growing regions in the country, driven by several Fortune 100 companies and University of Arkansas inside of our region. And Ozarks Electric Cooperative also has a significant need for communication for its electric devices, its substations, its downline SCADA devices, and eventually all the way to the electric meter. We have a significant investment we spend every year on communication needs, which is also one more driving purpose of us deploying a fiber-to-the-home network. Ozarks Go, as mentioned earlier, is a wholly owned subsidiary of Ozarks Electric. One note I want to mention, prior to joining Ozarks Go, I was general manager of Como Connect, a subsidiary of Como Electric Cooperative in central Missouri, where we deployed a 4,000-mile fiber-to-the-home network that now has over 16,000 active fiber-to-the-home subscribers. Como is the First Electric Cooperative to deploy fiber to the home and make it available to 100% of its members, and it did it without any government grants or government subsidies. And we're trying to replicate the success of that project here at Ozarks. Next slide, please. So prior to starting the broadband project at Ozarks, this map, the black outline, indicates our service territory in Arkansas and Oklahoma. The red colored census blocks indicate where 25 megabit service is available. 25 megabits is currently the FCC's definition of broadband service. Right around half of Ozarks Electric members do not have access to broadband today, primarily in our Oklahoma portion of our service territory and the eastern rural portion of our territory do not have access to broadband. Next slide. But we're not just trying to get our members connected to what is considered broadband today. We're focused on delivering fiber to the home and gigabit speeds, and we're trying to bring our region up to what you could find in most urban areas in the country, and we believe that that is a minimum of 100 meg service. So when we look at only the census blocks in Ozarks territory that has 100 meg service, you can see a much smaller portion of our members have access to that level of service that you can find in major cities across the country. Next slide. So our project started back in March of 2016 with a board of directors approval to launch a six-phase project over 6 years to deploy fiber to the home on all 7,000 miles of our electric distribution line and to serve all 75,000 of our member locations. We started official construction in October of 2016. By December of 2016, we had completed our large data center, which houses our core routers and network infrastructure and IP television head-end. And by December 31st on 2016, we met our goal of having at least one subscriber online the network, just 9 months after project approval. By June of 2017, we had launched IP television service. And by October 2017, we had our 1,000th subscriber connected. And by the end of this year, our phase one of our six-phase project will be complete, and we'll have over 2,000 fiber-to-the-home subscribers connected. Looking at this map, this is a map of fully deployed gigabit networks. And by fully deployed, I mean the entire community has access to gigabit or entire service area from a provider has access to gigabit. So you can see it's rare for an entire community to have access to gigabit. As Brett mentioned, electric cooperatives, when they make service available, typically make the same level of service available to their entire service area and typically do it for the same price. So I think that makes us unique in the market. Next slide. So not only are we trying to solve the problem of getting broadband service where it's not available today, but it also has to be affordable. And this is the pricing that we're offering at Ozarks, $49.95, 100 meg service, $79.95 gigabit. Both of those are symmetrical, so the same upload as download speeds. IPTV television service, $65.95, and up to $129.95 for all the channels that you could ask for, and telephone service at $24.95 with unlimited local and long distance. We also offer bundle discounts, so if you take two services, it's a $10 discount. If you take three, it's a $20 discount. So as you can see, I think these rates are not just affordable for rural, but probably very affordable for most major cities in the country. Next slide. So as electric cooperatives have done before, economic development, as we embarked on this project that was our goals to bring economic development and to benefit our community. Some of those community benefits include while we're constructing the fiber, we've created over 300 jobs by either direct employees of the co-op and the subsidiary or employed by contractors over the next 6 years of construction. Obviously, there's lots of studies to show the benefits to a community when they have access to fiber to the home and gigabit type speeds. And then not just are we delivering service to where areas that do not have service today, we're delivering an affordable, very competitive service in areas where broadband is available, and we're saving our members money. We've calculated that we are going to put about $13 million per year in discretionary income or back into our members' pockets to spend on other things other than their telecommunication needs. Slide. That wraps up my presentation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Randy. Last but certainly not least, our final speaker is Paul Belk. Mr. Belk is the president and chief executive officer of the North Georgia Network, Incorporated, a fiber optic network that spans over 1,700 miles through northeast Georgia and western North Carolina. Mr. Belk is also the vice president of the Fiber Network Owners Alliance, a strategic alliance of 42 organizations with over 108,000 combined network miles. 20 years of experience in the telecommunications industry, Mr. Belk has a history of helping organizations realize short and long-term returns on fiber optic network investments. He specializes in the utility broadband sector and has operated several telecommunications companies throughout his career. Mr. Belk is an expert in the areas of wireless backhaul, long-term evolution deployment, and fiber-to-the-premise solutions. Please welcome Mr. Paul Belk.
Thank you, Scott. I really appreciate that introduction. Brett, it's nice to hear from you as well at UTC, and Randy, thank you for your contributions to all the cooperatives that are trying to carve out a space for themselves across the country for broadband. Again, thank you for inviting us all on this call today. If you'll go to the next slide, I wanted to jump into what NGN is. We are designed as more of a generation and transmission organization, a fiber optic system that is fully redundant as far as a ring topography. We have a core that extends down into metropolitan areas of Atlanta and then comes into the north, North Georgia, into our respective EMC areas to deliver services from anyone from enterprise to fiber to the home. We have 1,700 miles of fiber infrastructure, and we do consider it next generation because we built it for it on a 10-year focus. It is focused on community and economic development because as our owners being cooperatives, their members are their owners, and so we always like to translate direct benefit back to them. Next slide. This is just a look from a mapping standpoint. You can see Atlanta there to the southwest. The network extends on the western side in a protect path. We do not render services over on that side. You'll see that there is a span going into Chattanooga, Tennessee. That is where we purchase alternate IP so that we can bring internet traffic from an alternative rather than just the Atlanta network access points. We have done that just because we have such density onto the network now, anything from an E911 center to critical EMS facilities throughout the region. We have to have that type of redundancy. So it's we have three locations within this footprint, Young Harris, where Blue Ridge Mountain EMC is. We have Clarksville, Georgia, where Habersham EMC is. And then we have the Dawsonville location where it houses Georgia Communications Cooperative. Next slide. Just to illustrate an idea, you know, cooperatives are doing broadband business. However, it's interesting to see how cooperatives can then leverage their resources to put together larger solutions. This, you can see, is really geared towards a mid-Atlantic focus. We are one of seven owners of Lit Networks, which is a compilation of seven organizations that basically put fiber in together. The managing partner, being Mid-Atlantic Broadband, put the DWDM network together, and now we all share in the revenues for these long transport routes. So it gives us additional verticals to sell into our communities. Next slide. Just some facts about the network. We're probably creeping on to 10,000 subscribers now onto the network. Again, you saw that 1,700 miles of operating fiber. Gig is our, as Randy said, we have a gig-enabled community. Our primary focus is to provide gigabit connectivity on every media gateway that we put onto a premise. So we do deploy some wireless infrastructure. It is really a stopgap measure in order for us to eventually bring fiber. And again, the focus on uptime on five nines, we really want to differentiate ourselves from the competition, and reliability is one of the big ways we do. Next slide. How did it start? NGN was very fortunate to receive a grant during the in 2009 through the Department of Commerce, actually through the NTIA, who's actually putting on this call today, and we were very grateful. Scott Woods was our program manager, and we have really benefited from the department's involvement in our ability to take our fate into our own hands. We had closures of businesses. We had organizations that would not locate here because we had no broadband, and it was really kind of a great case scenario for us to bring towards those that were holding those funds and then make a case for us to distribute and build a network. So the next slide. Again, this was a regional effort. There were economic development professionals from many regions that created joint development authorities that partnered with EMCs. These that you see here are Blue Ridge Mountain EMC and Habersham EMC. They combined their utility resources and knowledge of the region, and we created a corporation to serve the entire fabric across our communities. So it's really a joint effort of many different parties that had to come together, and it's really cooperative in the spirit of it is indeed it became it was kind of convenient for us to organize a cooperative considering what we were trying to accomplish. Again, around 10,000 of the EMC's customers have received broadband services to date. Next slide. Our story is that because we have, we wanted to create flexibility within our corporate structure, NGN being a generation and transmission type entity to provide services, engineering services, NOC services, bandwidth services to our respective distributors, we needed another instrument to serve areas that these EMCs were not serving. So we created a third member. It is NGN Connect, and it serves in areas that there is not a focus for the EMCs to. So this is just gives you some of the nuances of how we're put together, and it really just provides us the flexibility to serve any community member, irregardless of what distributor is available to them. So next slide. So the model is typically what we see, and Brett and Randy have mentioned the utility, if you will, of having fiber for an EMC to maintain its smart grid infrastructure. It will need to be as efficient and robust as even those within metropolitan areas because EMCs face the same crisis on cost of energy going up and revenues falling, so they need to be able to demonstrate competence within demand side management and all types of things. In parallel with that, they can leverage these assets and lease them to an entity like NGN, and then a retail provider can come and provide services. There are models where the EMC is the retailer directly, and that works very well. For our purposes across this large landscape that we wanted to serve, we needed some flexibility, and hence the design. So next slide. For utilities, the greater network redundancy and security variants of protect paths you always see within electrical design, if there are mission-critical applications, they will look for two different source stations. We tried to emulate that within, obviously, our network design for NGN. And again, network capacity cannot be overlooked. We, despite our being in rural areas, we see a population that is hungry for bandwidth, and you have to be ready to serve that. And the next thing for EMCs is another revenue source. We think that it's going to be an emerging opportunity, and it already is, for EMCs to provide services that they can naturally provide to their members. Next slide. Again, from the cooperative standpoint, shared resources when you're dealing with high-cost areas is really a key component of being successful. You have to utilize skill sets that would otherwise be expensive and spread them across, the economies of scale in order to be successful. So network expertise, not contact centers, marketing and branding, government relations, consolidating your buying power, all those things are imperative to leverage when you're operating within the confines of a cooperative. So we are able to address regional and statewide multi-locations, too, because we are, in effect, together. So we can provide one vendor of record for many different locations. Infrastructure support and disaster recovery go hand in hand. As different regulations, both on the telecom and from the regulation and regulatory bodies for electric or FERC, continue to increase, this will put cooperatives into a strategic advantage to meet all of those requirements in the future. Next. And that's it. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Paul. And thank you again, Paul, Randy, and Brett, for your time and presentations today. This was very useful information on the opportunities that electric co-ops have to bring or provide fiber networks to rural America. We will now open up the webinar for questions from our participants. I will turn it over to Karen Peary, who will facilitate the question and answer session. Karen? Okay, we seem to have some technical difficulties with Karen, so I am going to take some questions. We have a question here from Marilyn Cross. It says, does the IP television service have similar limitations to live streaming services, such as Hulu Live? Can any of our experts answer that question, and I'll try to find a more applicable question as we begin the question and answer session.
This is Randy. Ozarks has deployed an IPTV platform, which really mimics regular cable television. So it's more of a linear product than it is an over-the-top like a Hulu or a Netflix. It's the same technology that AT&T has deployed in UVerse or CenturyLink in Prism or others that are deploying kind of a closed-loop IP linear t- television product.
Thank you very much. Here's the next question from Bob Balance. Where can I find a vetted financial model that would help co-ops to understand the economic value and potential return on deploying broadband?
Hey, Scott, while the speakers think about that, can you hear me?
Yes, you're on. Thank you very much.
Okay, good. I'm sorry. I'll pick it up again after this.
Not a problem.
This is Randy. I'll take
Randy,
that.
Randy, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, I'll take the question.
Thank you.
I don't know if there's a particular financial model that's available for someone to produce their own numbers, but there are a multitude of consultants that can do financial modeling for an electric cooperative that is exploring a broadband or fiber to the home network. I would just encourage you to look for a consultant that works specifically with electric cooperatives because of the rural nature of the build being on and taking advantage of electric cooperative assets and abilities to look for somebody that has that experience.
Let me ask this question any speaker who wants to answer. Are you aware of any co-ops who have used a hybrid fiber wireless solution to bring down their deployment costs?
Yes. This is Paul Belk. We have done that to a limited extent, but I don't think that ultimately wireless, being a perpetual hybrid status would be advisable, because I think that in the short run, there are solutions that can meet the FCC minimum standard for 25 and 3. It's going to be a stretch with LTE, and depending on what the operator is, how they're operating, what channels they're operating on, fiber is really going to be one of the best long-term solutions. I think companies or consulting firms like Connexon generally advise that if you're going to have a long-term strategy of 6 to 7 years of deployment, don't be unfocused with, and I don't want to speak for you, Randy, but I see that there is a value in being focused on getting the long-term solution in first rather than, taking up and duplicating resources, because you have to have folks that are cross-pollinated or have different departments in order to support the services.
Randy?
I was just going to add one point to Paul's. Our principle is all electric cooperative members have access to the same level of service at the same price. So that kind of rules out hybrid wireless fiber networks.
So it's kind of part of the philosophy.
Are you
aware of any electric co-ops who have been able to get financing either from local banks or through SBA loans in order to finance their deployments?
This is Randy. Every cooperative that I've worked with has got their financing through either RUS or CoBank or CFC. I'm not personally aware of any that have used local financing lending institutions.
Does anybody else have any experience with local lending institutions in this area?
NGN does. We deal with regional banks that, and the lines range from, hundreds of thousands to, millions. But, they're typically, once you get into the, six digits, seven digits, then you start looking for more conventional or at least larger aggregation banks like CoBank or CFC and the like.
And regional banks and banks can get Community Reinvestment Act credits for broadband investments. So perhaps that's something we'll see more of in the future. Let me ask if any of you have had encountered issues with rights of way and how you've managed through those issues. Randy, want to start that one?
Well, sure. I'll go back to the COMO project where we deployed in Missouri, and that project was complete. Mm-hmm. We didn't have any right-of-way issues there, and it's really a state-by-state issue. So I think it's something you have to really evaluate your state laws for your right to do that. Arkansas, for example, has the Broadband Over Power Lines Act that allows electric utilities to use their electrical infrastructure to deploy broadband in the same rights of way, so that clears the way for electric utilities in the state of Arkansas.
Brett, can you give some examples of kind of what speeds are being offered kind of across the field by electric co-ops and roughly how much people are charging or companies
sure.
are charging?
Sure, I can take a stab at that. I'm sure Randy's also got a good sense of what other utility companies are offering. But yeah, it ranges from about $80, you know, for 100 meg services or gig services potentially, up to about $100 for you know gig services. That's typically what they're offering around the country for those. They have service packages that start probably in about $50 for a triple play type of package. But yeah, that's what you'll see generally, you know, amongst various different electric cooperatives, whether you're looking in one area or the other. Randy, you want to try and add anything with that?
Most of the cooperatives that I work with typically try to price their entry level, which is a 100 meg service at $49 or $59, and then gig services from $79 to $99.
Well, isn't that a nice phrase, entry level at 100 megabits per second, particularly in rural America? There's some states that have restrictions about municipal broadband or community broadband. One of our questioners wants to know if those restrictions are equally applicable to electric co-ops or if you've been able to deploy in places that do have limitations in the legal framework.
There are, within the state of Georgia at least, there are certain things. For instance, there's what's called the EMC Enabling Act, and there's probably a form of this in most, if not all, states, I suppose. Some states are very hands-off with EMCs. However, in the state of Georgia, they're not real prescriptive about it, but they do outline like four baseline things that are very clear, that makes it clear that what they can serve. The consensus is that it is undetermined as it, whether or not within the state of Georgia. So there have been some steps taken to protect EMCs, whether it be a subsidiary or really even a organization that is separate from the EMC to render service. So you do see some of that going on within the United States. So Brett may have a different vantage point on that.
No, you're right. I mean, there are, you know, approximately, I think, 20 states that actually have restrictions on public power, primarily utility broadband. And most recently in Tennessee, they passed a law that not only provides a new subsidy program, but also allows the co-ops to be able to offer retail broadband. Previously, they were restricted, and so long as they're not competing with a private entity. And so the idea behind it is, you know, they want to allow the electric cooperatives to go out and be able to provide broadband to those unserved areas in the state of Tennessee.
So a number of our questioners are interested in learning more about the relationships that these companies, that your co-ops and your networks have with other retail service providers, including the traditional providers, both in the planning stages. Are you working in areas where some of those providers have some presence? And then once your networks are built, Are you using ever a wholesale retail model where service providers are riding on your network? So that's kind of an important one. So I'd love it if each of you would kind of comment on the relationship between your networks and your services and traditional, existing, or new service providers.
I'll jump in, and you know, for folks that want to dive in as well, please chime in. We do have some providers, utilities, that are actually offering a wholesale model. So the one that leaps to mind is Huntsville. They are deploying the fiber, and then they are leasing it to third-party ISPs, most notably Google, that has used the capacity on the Huntsville fiber network to be able to provide service in that area. There are other utilities that, you know, are strictly wholesale. I mean, they provide long-haul transport to all kinds of third-party providers, whether they're telcos or broadband service providers. They tend to be some of the larger utilities, whether they're generation and transmission utilities or large public power providers or big investor-owned. But they represent sort of a, unrecognized resource to a certain extent, and one that I think has a lot of potential in the sense that even though they're not retail providers, they can certainly enable access into some of those rural areas by providing that backbone that's needed to be able to get into the middle mile. So I'll stop there. Randy, Paul, you guys want to add anything?
For us, you know, we provide wholesale services from, just terminating traffic from other providers onto the network, meaning if someone needs a 10 meg circuit to service multiple locations and it's AT&T or if it's Comcast, we provide that service. On one level, we're wholesale. On another level, there are retail service providers through our membership that provide internet service products throughout the region. So it's what they call co-opetition, or fairly incestuous business, I suppose, because there's an interesting...
Co-opetition much better.
Yeah, I know. Well... Co-opetition is really the term that has really made it, it's just relevant. It makes sense because you can't be all places and all things to all people, and even AT&T knows that. They have to have off-net providers, so why not co-ops operate in that way?
Let me ask you one final question, and I'd like a quick response from each one of you. Because these are really high-capacity deployments in rural areas, can you give an example of a regional or local economic benefit that you've seen as a result of your network deployment? Paul, would you like to start that one off?
Sure. We've seen our medical industry absolutely explode. Namely, Northeast Georgia Medical has expanded their disaster recovery presence throughout the northeast sector of the state. Their satellite offices are opening up faster than we can get them connected. They're all at, of course, gigabit speeds and greater. And then, of course, our schools are also equipped with gigabit capacity. I think what this in the economic development formula comes to mind is that if we have sufficient facilities and broadband access for young people to use as a tool to learn and to go to school locally and create jobs locally, we've even seen some even data centers that have located within our region because there's multiple providers, not just one, and the tax incentives were decent. So, you know, everything ranging from, you know, higher education to material movements of people actually coming. And one other thing, too, that I think is a benefit is we're seeing where folks that or work from home are actually bringing more of their assets or more of their business into our region because they no longer have to really treat their second home as really second class. They can work out of it. We have a large second home community around lakes in the North Georgia region, and it's where a lot of people from Atlanta come to play, but they are now showing signs of staying. So it's interesting to see the dynamic.
And Randy, do you have an economic benefit that you wanted to mention from your experience?
Yeah, real quick, the Como Electric Project, we did an analysis, and it goes to the last point I made in my presentation, that we saved our members on average $25 per month in service, which injected about $4 million a year in discretionary income back into our members' pockets. And also, Como has been named by the Forbes Technology Council as one of the top 10 areas for where the next Silicon Valley will pop up because of their gigabit service that they've launched. So it's got national attention from Forbes, listed alongside Shanghai, China, Toronto, Israel, and even Atlanta because of its low cost of living and gigabit internet service. So those are probably the two quickest examples I can think of.
Well, Brent, I got to tell you, his examples were so good that I think we're going to wrap it on that, and I'm going to hand it back to Scott to close out this webinar.
Thank you, Karen, and the participants for your questions. As we conclude today, I want to remind you all that Broadband USA is available to provide technical assistance to help expand broadband capacity and promote digital inclusion and broadband adoption. For more information, please email us at broadbandusa@ntia.doc.gov, or you may visit our website for more information. Finally, Broadband USA's webinars are scheduled for the third Wednesday of each month at 2 p.m. Eastern. Please note that we will not have a webinar next month in December. We thank you all for joining us today, and please join us again on Wednesday, January 17, 2018, for our next webinar on innovative funding solutions for digital inclusion programs. Thank you all, and have a great afternoon.